Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me a chance to present this work. And since this is the last talk, and I'll probably forget if I wait till the end, I thought maybe now would be a good time to thank the organizers for providing such a wonderful workshop for us. I've certainly learned a lot from it, so let's give them a round of applause. Okay, so I'll be talking about local bulk operators and ADS-CFT, and this is some work I've been doing over the last year and a half in collaboration with Alex Hamilton, a PhD student at Columbia, Daniel Kabat, and Gilad Lifshitz. Okay, so let me just go over the broad plan of my talk. Kind of the ultimate goal of all of this work is to go from some set of CFT operators in some appropriate approximation to some kind of description of a bulk effective action around some background geometry. So what we've learned is that there are situations in which we can map this set of CFT correlators into what looks like a local bulk theory with an extra dimension. Okay, so ultimately we'd like to know what are the general circumstances under which we can make this kind of correspondence. So to do that, I'm going to first revamp the standard mapping that one uses between CFT quantities and bulk quantities. So the way things were done in the original papers on ADS-CFT is that you take, if you want to construct a local bulk operator, you need to take some kind of local CFT operator and smear it over the whole boundary of ADS. So usually this is done in Euclidean ADS. So that's pretty much the only option. We're going to work in Lorentzian ADS and try and improve the situation. And our general strategy is to try and make the boundary domain over which we need to integrate to get a local bulk operator, we want to make that boundary domain as compact as possible, roughly speaking. So I'll try and follow through this program in a couple of different steps and then give various applications of it. One of the nice things that will come out of this reformulation of the bulk to boundary map is that if we want to prove bulk locality, and I'm going to be using the same kind of approximations that Hong used in his talk on Wednesday, namely that we'll be taking n to infinity and working in a limit where g string n is very large. And we're just going to work at leading order in 1 over n for this initial analysis. Okay, so in that approximation.
Well, naive question. Is the ADS-CFT correspondence true for Lorentzian spacetimes and Lorentzian?
It's conjectured to be true.
Is the evidence for the Lorentzian correspondence is for the correspondence, or is one follow from the other?
To the extent that you can just analytically continue one from the other, it follows.
Analytic continuation is easy on the boundary.
Well, in fact, I would think that
that's all you're doing.
When?
That's all you're doing.
Well,
you're just rotating the Lorentzian time on the boundary to Euclidean time.
You have Lorentzian ADS out there also.
And that continues Lorentzian ADS to Euclidean ADS at the same time.
But if you just look at the isomorphism group for the Lorentzian case, it's well-defined, it's SO2,4 crosses SO6, comes a supergenerator. And then in the Euclidean case, you have to worry about, Euclidean Mariana spinners and things like that. So I would think that
Lorentzian ADS, it doesn't mean the whole geometry of the ADS. just means asymptotically, it doesn't guess. Or you can continue it asymptotically, but in the interior, you've got a dynamical black hole or something.
That's, well, we'll get into that more as the talk progresses, but at zeroth order, one just kind of formulates this bulk to boundary map around empty ADS space. So I'll get towards, around the middle of my talk, I'll start talking about black hole geometries and time-dependence collapse geometries. Those are the kinds of things we can work into this picture. Okay, so I'd like to follow through this general strategy. And once I've done that, I'll be able to, say, do commutator calculations of bulk supergravity fields and show that you no longer require quite so many miraculous cancellations in order to show vanishing of commutators at space-like separations, which is obviously going to be very obscure if you take this kind of point of view where you're really smearing over the entire boundary. Another thing we can understand is the appearance of bulk light cone singularities. I won't have much to say about that today, but it's discussed in our papers. By formulating the correspondence on a compact boundary domain, it'll give us a much sharper picture of the relation between the infrared cutoff in ADS and an actual ultraviolet cutoff in the conformal field theory. Another thing that will come out of this analysis is it'll kind of give us a natural basis of operators to build local operators in some finite volume and count them. So there seems to be a fairly convincing way of extending that kind of reasoning to finite n, which gives a nice picture of holographic entropy counting. And finally, of most interest for the present workshop, is we can actually build local operators behind black hole horizons and take them towards the singularity of the black hole and ask exactly what that corresponds to in the conformal field theory, and that'll give us, at least in the examples we look at, a fairly detailed understanding of how that singularity is resolved or to what extent it's resolved. We'll discuss that more at the end. And finally, if you were suspicious that a lot of this relies on properties of static geometries and geometries with very special symmetries. Well, that might be true, but at least we can look at some generalizations to collapsing geometries and basically prove all the same statements, which is at least a sign that most of this discussion will carry over in some form in general. Okay, so we're going to be doing something a little bit different from the usual bulk to boundary map in ADS CFT. So I'm just going to begin by explaining the traditional view of this, so you can see the differences that I'll be employing. Okay, so let's say we begin with just a pure ADS geometry. This is so-called Poincaré coordinates, where we just have a flat metric with a conformal factor in front. So we go to the boundary of ADS by taking this radial coordinate z to 0. And you can show that if you, say, have some bulk scalar field, then it has this kind of behavior as z goes to 0. So delta is going to be related to the conformal dimension of the CFT operator, which is fixed in terms of the mass of the scalar field. So this is some positive number. In general, I'm going to take it to be bigger than d. So this part will blow up. This will be a non-normalizable part, and this will be a normalizable part. So in the usual way of thinking about things, we identify this factor as a kind of fluctuation of the field that is then determined by the wave equation in terms of the source, which we identify with the coefficient of this non-normalizable operator. of this non-normalizable term. Okay, and delta is just determined in terms of the mass of the scalar field by this formula. Okay, so that's the usual picture of things from Witten and Gubser, Klebanoff, and Polyakov. So you can write down a bulk-to-boundary propagator that relates that source to a general field at some arbitrary point in the bulk space-time. Okay, and to do that, you have to integrate over the entire boundary of ADS. And you can write down this fairly simple form for the propagator. And in particular, you'll notice it falls off at large values of the distance. Okay. Let's see. So what can we do? Well, we can say have a delta function source on the boundary. And when we do that, we notice this coefficient phi zero of x can actually be precisely identified with a CFT two-point function. So it is then correct to think of this coefficient as a source for the operator with conformal dimension delta being inserted at the origin. And this then is just this proportional to this CFT two-point function. Okay, so we conclude this non-normalizable component of the bulk field behaves as a source for CFT operators. So we can then start looking at higher point correlation functions, and the natural set of observables then can be thought of as a kind of boundary S matrix that we get by looking at these bulk correlators with insertions that approach the boundary of ADS. So most people, I think, would regard that as a kind of complete set of observables in this CFT. Of course, it's not immediately related to the kind of local observables that I would like to be addressing today. Okay, so some of the basic issues are we need to do this integral over the entire boundary, and if we want to prove things like vanishing of commutators of bulk operators at space-like separations, we need to use some very delicate cancellations. And that one example was worked out by Josef Benya, I think, while he was a student here. That actually got us thinking about trying to generalize this picture.
That is worked out when you think of the bulk fields as being free fields.
Yeah,
so is there a sense in which it's understood when they are interacting fields?
Well, pretty much all I'm going to say is just about the case where you're looking at the free fields. And to put in 1 over n corrections and look at interactions is not something I'm going to have anything to say about in any detail today, but once you've got the free story sorted out, you can certainly try and address that kind of question. But I'm not going to have much to say about that today. Okay, so that was for Euclidean ADS. One tack you can take is to continue that previous story to Lorentzian ADS, just rotating T to IT.
Excuse me, I have a question, because you were just mentioning locality.
Mm-hmm.
And locality means commutativity at space-like distances.
That's right.
When you rotate to Euclidean space, then simply the field operators...
I perhaps should have put this comment on the next slide, but yeah, this was for Lorentzian ADS. Oops. So we can continue to Lorentzian ADS, this was the original way of thinking about things as appeared in the papers by these authors and various linear combinations of them. So what, So in position space, that's a little bit confusing because you get a bulk to boundary propagator that you're integrating across light cone singularities. And if you want to adopt a position space view of that, you kind of have to deal with these light cone singularities. So what's usually done is to work in momentum space, for example, as Hong was doing on Wednesday. So instead, what you can do in Lorentzian ADS CFT is to notice that there is a kind of distinguished compact region, namely the region that's space-like separated from the bulk point that you're interested in. So in Lorentzian ADS, you should then have the option of trying to formulate a correspondence where a local operator inserted at this point is only smeared over some compact subset of ADS. And this is the kind of viewpoint we worked out in the first couple of papers we wrote on the subject. And one could even try doing other analytic continuations, which I'll talk about later today, and try and do even better. So that's where I'm going to be heading later in the talk today. But for now, let's just stick with Lorentzian ADS and see how we can formulate this bulk-to-boundary map. And I'll work in global coordinates for the sake of definiteness. Okay, so I'm going to change the picture a bit and just demand that my bulk fields satisfy normalizable boundary conditions at infinity. So I'm just going to get rid of all of those non-normalizable modes from the beginning. So as I go towards the boundary, I'm going to get some characteristic fall off of the field, and I'll have this kind of fluctuation piece that just depends on the boundary coordinates, and then some higher order corrections. Okay, and I'm going to formulate everything in terms of an ADS invariant distance function. Okay, so this is related to the geodesic length along space-like or time-like geodesics, separating two different points. Okay,
so is your goal, you say you're working only with normalizable modes.
That's right.
And is your goal then to sort of determine the field in the interior just from the sort of leading behavior on the boundary?
Yes.
But that's not what I thought normalizable modes were supposed to do, right? Normalizable modes are sort of, ordinary Cauchy data on a space-like surface. Which, I think of it more in terms of the usual Cauchy property. These are some states, so you would specify them in one moment of time and determine them.
So we're roughly speaking doing a kind of a Legendre transformation of the usual bulk to boundary map, but I don't want to push that analogy too far.
Isn't it just like using initial data on past null infinity?
That's the way I'm thinking of it. But,
okay, but you're going to only use it on this little strip of infinity. Well, why don't you go ahead?
So the condition of normalizability places non-trivial constraints on what can happen across this kind of surface. Okay. So we have these normalizable bulk fields, and what we can derive, and I won't go through the derivation of it because it's fairly technical, but we can derive, instead of this relation between a bulk field and the non-normalizable part of the boundary data, we can derive we can determine this bulk field in terms of this normalizable part of the boundary data using a different bulk-to-boundary kernel, which we call the smearing function. And it's very different from what we had before, and you'll kind of notice it's, well, it's similar, but we've replaced the minus delta power with delta minus d. And we also have this step function for space-like separations present. Okay, so that restricts us to this yellow strip in the previous diagram. And now we have a kernel that grows as the separation between points increases. Okay, so it's only going to be well-defined then because of this step function cutoff on our total integrals here will be finite because we're just integrating over this compact region.
So what happens in the case of null separation? Is this thing vanish for null separation, or is it?
Yeah.
It does. It really is just. So the limit as you approach a null separation is also zero?
Yes. So as you take. So this is now going like some positive power of the distance. So, yeah. So that'll go to zero then on the light cone.
Okay. I'm really sort of puzzled now because if I feel the point, and you know, usually causality would say that it's affected only by things which are timeline related to it. Mm-hmm. So I would have thought exactly the opposite is true. That the behavior of the fields of a large space-like distances is sort of irrelevant to what's happening here, and that if you should be integrating over things which are sort of inside of the past light cones, and maybe taking the sort of going out to infinity, you could register everything at infinity, but sort of in the past light cone would have to be included. So what did you do?
It's this condition that the bulk field is normalizable that is giving you this non-trivial relation between this boundary data and the boundary data that you're more accustomed to.
Roughly, he's characterizing the mode that he's measuring by its very small tail, sort of off the spatial.
Yeah.
You're sort of performing a map between that tail and the field.
But I could take data of compact support, which is sort of a zero outside a while, and evolve it out, and just zero everywhere in his space line. You must be assuming analyticity or something.
No, it's actually not zero everywhere. The tricky thing, right, I think this is some limiting issue here. If you take your data of compact support, then you've excited the field at more than one point in the interior.
Sure.
If I look at one point in the interior and draw his space-like cone, right, then that space-like cone includes the other points you've excited.
Nice.
So, in fact, some of that information will flow out and hit his boundary. I mean, there may be some, if his yellow region was epsilon bigger, we'd have no in-principle objection. And so there may be just some.
Does this work really work for data compact support?
You haven't used
the sensible thing.
Well, let's see. Well, I would not really be comfortable with the statement that we're not using analyticity at all. The whole talk is going to be using analyticity.
The assumption that the solution itself is analytic? That the normalizable mode is analytic? The background is analytic?
Well, I mean,
do you think this works for a smooth normalizable mode or just those three structures?
Well, maybe, the answers we're going to get will be independent of the choice of coordinates. So I'm going to prove the results by going to some coordinate system where I can use the analyticity of the coordinates and their action on modes.
Rho is a space-like coordinate. And so what you're essentially doing looks like trying to evolve Laplace's equation rather than trying to evolve the wave equation. So you're allowed to do that provided that your data is analytic, but if your data is not analytic, things fail badly. So I think that's why the compact support stuff does work. And presumably, for the data compact support that you want, this wouldn't work because the sequence of analytic functions would just not convert. So I think that's crucial here.
Yeah.
I don't see how it could possibly work otherwise, because it's not like evolving a wave equation. It's more like evolving a Laplace's equation, which you're in general not allowed to do, but which you are allowed to do if things are analytic.
Yeah. So.
I'm even more confused because given data on one slice of the boundary, I mean, you're assuming this stuff satisfies equations of motion, right?
I'm happy to put conditions on the kind of data that are not necessarily the same kind of conditions you're used to putting on initial data.
Okay.
Let's just say I'm going to assume everything's going to be analytic.
To satisfy equations of motion, right?
Yeah.
So given data on the boundary on one slice,
yeah,
you determine the field everywhere on the boundary for all time, outside of your yellow region. So, of course, I don't see the problem. I mean, you could determine, you could shrink the yellow region to an even narrower strip, and in principle, all the information is.
No, he's using only the bulk equations of motion. And a little thin slice of the boundary is not a Cauchy surface for bulk evolution.
But it doesn't matter, because he needs analyticity. Once he has analyticity, data in any little strip determines the data everywhere else. And it doesn't work if it's not analytic.
Yeah.
So you think you are using analyticity as a bulk solution?
Well, this is one of the motivations for looking at this collapse solution that I'll talk about towards the end, to kind of test whether you can cover that kind of situation, where you would think things like a collapsing shell would generate non-analyticities that you couldn't handle. Well, we'll see we can, in fact, handle it. So that will work okay. But okay. Okay, so, but, well, as a field theorist, I don't have any problem using analyticity in situations where a relativist would be very uncomfortable with the kinds of conditions that's putting on initial data.
What you're going to mean by locality if all your field operators are now on the analytic functions of the coordinates? Because normally we regulate the operators by taking a smearing phi to point with a function of compact support.
Even field theorists can agree.
Yeah.
This is the confusion, but we should let you go with your talk.
Yeah, no, you will be allowed to do that for the operators that I construct. Okay, let's see. So we get this explicit formula for even-dimensional ADS. If we want to play the same game for odd-dimensional ADS, it turns out we need to use a somewhat different smearing function. If we just use the kind of naive replacement of the one I just showed you on the previous slide, the integral would actually vanish when you perform the integral over the yellow region. It turns out the right thing to do is to put a log there. Just to emphasize, these results we get are dependent on this geodesic length. We have these Weyl rescaling factors that define the transformation between this boundary data and, we can re-express these Weyl rescaling factors in terms of invariant quantities if we want to. So the final answer we get for the integral does turn out to be coordinate invariant. So it's easy to then generalize this result to whatever coordinates you want. This term looks a little bit suspicious, but because of that statement I made before that the integral of the previous kernel vanishes for the yellow region, it turns out that transformations of that part will always drop out. Okay, so we get a somewhat different bulk to boundary map where we can localize everything to this yellow region here. Okay, and we are making assumptions about analyticity, and we're imposing, which I would phrase as simply imposing the condition that the bulk field is normalizable near the boundary. Okay, so summary so far. We're dealing with these normalizable modes. We can represent any bulk operator in terms of this boundary data. So instead of the usual map between CFT operator O and sources, we instead get a map that's kind of a Legendre transform of that between the CFT operator and this this part of the boundary field, which we usually would think of as a fluctuation. So we can then go about reconstructing supergravity correlation functions. And we do that with these new smearing functions, and we just integrate, convolute them with the CFT correlator. Okay, so since these are all non-vanishing time-like separations, we avoid these kind of light cone singularities that would have appeared if you tried to do the same kind of position space version of the bulk to boundary map using the old kind of formulation of things. Okay. Okay, so far so good. So you might try and go even further by using properties of analyticity. So you might imagine, say, taking some little chunk of the boundary and scaling up your boundary coordinates so that, for example, you might have time going to infinity on some finite chunk of the ADS boundary. So an example is, say, Poincaré coordinates that I showed you at the beginning. And you might try and then use analyticity of the global modes and various symmetries of these modes to try and map everything into a single Poincaré patch. So rather than having this yellow region going off in all directions, you might try and squash it all into a single Poincaré patch using properties of analyticity. And the resounding answer to that kind of attempt is that it works sometimes. So for even dimensional ADS, you can do it pretty well. And you get something very similar to what I just showed you. The only difference is this factor of two. Okay, so so we have exactly the same kind of smearing function written in terms of this geodesic length, and we have the same kind of Weyl rescaling factor that appears there. Okay, but it doesn't work at all for odd ADS unless you put some kind of restrictions on the conformal weight. So sometimes you can get away with using analyticity to make your boundary operators even more compact and still obtain a local bulk field. Okay, so we'd like to do even better. So for Lorentzian ADS, we could localize to this yellow region, but it still isn't that useful for us. It at least means in certain situations there'll be some cancellations that weren't entirely obvious from the beginning. But we'd like something much more transparent. And the way we'll proceed there is to do some further analytic continuation. And now we'll continue all of the boundary coordinates to imaginary values, which is going to take us to a kind of de Sitter space where the radial direction becomes a time-like direction. And I should perhaps emphasize that you shouldn't think of this as a proof. This is something we did by working with the ADS representation of the bulk field. But this is the geometric picture that, that comes out of that proof. So it's much simpler just to state it this way. So essentially what we're doing then is thinking of time running in this direction. And we're, all we're saying then is that we can represent this local bulk field in terms of smearing a retarded propagator along along its past light cone.
Yeah, so from the point of view of relativity, I mean, that actually works even without allosticity. I mean, this is like these old, you know, the stuff that Thomas Friedrichs does where he puts the data on the past De Sitter space and, you know, conformally compactifies. And so, the sort of past of De Sitter space is actually a perfectly good initial data surface where you can, you know, put scalar fields and a gravitational field and then just see what happens.
Yeah.
At least it can conformally compactify.
Yeah, you can conformally rescale fine, but this is also switching R and T. Right? Friedrichs has a space like surface which you can then evolve normally once he conformally rescales to a finite distance. In this case, you're sort of assuming that you can switch analytically continuous. You say T into a space-like variable,
yeah.
R into a time-like variable, and then sort of view that as evolving gradient.
Yeah.
So is that surface the equivalent of the, you know, infinite past conformal boundary in Sitter space, or is it a different surface?
Well,
it is.
It's analogous to it, but it's a time-like surface in the Lorentzian space that you have to.
So that's not one of the things that gets switched.
No.
Okay. All right. So maybe it doesn't work any better then.
Well, no. It is true in the imaginary directions. It does look like the usual asymptotic boundary of De Sitter space.
Okay. But if you you're analytically continuing in a global R variable or a corporate time.
Well, the way I said it was I'm going to leave R fixed and continue just the boundary coordinates, the boundary directions.
Is that R's time lock in the bulk?
Well, that's not the way I drew it here. So R is in this direction. And
it seems to me that was the usual picture of a point, you know, determined by its past light cone.
Yeah.
Data on a surface, thinking of R as the time-like variable.
Maybe I should have rotated. That's what it was intended to look like.
Okay. So then maybe it's okay.
Okay. Okay. So in this case, it's then clear we get compact support on this complexified boundary, and this will be our kind of. Well, for us, the most compact way we found of representing a local bulk operator. Okay, so we'll explore the consequences of this in the remainder of the talk. Okay, so some nice features. If we pull this point off to the boundary, we see it does indeed shrink to a very tiny region as we approach the boundary. And we wind up with a coordinate invariant formulation, as is kind of implied by this picture. Although, to provide the proofs of this, as I mentioned before, we, you know, work in some background and we pick some nice coordinate system that we can analytically continue in a straightforward way in order to prove it. But the fact that it matches with this nice geometric picture suggests we do indeed have a coordinate invariant formulation of things.
For a general time-dependent background, would you have any idea what you're
using? No. So I'm just going to talk about the case of a shell at the end to show that things don't go horribly wrong, but that's an open question, I think. Okay. So let me go through one example of this this way of thinking about things. And we'll just work with ADS3. And we'll work in Rindler coordinates because later we're going to talk about applying all this to black holes. So we can get a black hole, a BTZ black hole, by making a periodic identification in this ADS3 and Rindler coordinates, which is just going to periodically identify this angle variable phi. Okay, so we have these kind of coordinates that describe a kind of acceleration horizon in ADS. So a single Rindler patch would just correspond to this little triangle here, and we need some number of them, was it 8 or something, to go over the whole of ADS. So there are other patches up here and down here that I haven't drawn. So suppose we take a point, a bulk point inside one of the Rindler patches. Then we can represent that bulk point in terms of just an integral over boundary data along here. So it's much more compact than what we were dealing with before. So we can write it in terms of a very similar smearing function. And as I mentioned, we've continued our boundary coordinate to imaginary values. So we need to then continue our CFT operators likewise to imaginary values of the coordinates. Okay, so we wind up with this kind of integral.
So the picture is part of Lorentzian section of this complexified space, or is it some other complexified section?
Okay, so we're starting out with Lorentzian ADS. So all these coordinates, so these are just some rescaled coordinates. So these are coordinates on Lorentzian ADS, and the only new continuation is this thing here.
But it looks on the face of it like what you're doing is the ordinary Green's function on conformally compactified de Sitter space, and then some
That's
sort
right.
of analytic continuation back.
That's right.
Okay.
But I mean, this picture would have a similar picture one would have drawn for the standard bulk operators shadow on the boundary, the original description that you get in terms of the spatting on the bulk to boundary propagator. The same picture would have built in. I don't see why this is more compact.
Oh, so I should explain what space like means here. I mean a disk in this complexified geometry. So it's really just a compact disk now. And before we had this this light cone that would, for example, have if we had what we had before, we would have a light cone going off in this direction as well. And that would become very large if we took that point towards this boundary. So we can completely get rid of that part of the operator and write everything just in terms of data in this one patch.
Instead of a complement of a usual light cone, you have anything outside of the pan light curves, you have
nothing
that would have been a light cone if the time direction was the radial one.
That's right. So, time is behaving as it usually does. We haven't continued that. So this is the limits on time are just what you would get by looking at a light cone in ADS. Okay, and we can write down this geodesic length and continue it to these complex angles. Okay, so that's what we get if we have a point inside the Rindler horizon. Outside the Rindler horizon. Next, we can go inside the Rindler horizon and ask what happens. If we follow the same prescription, and we're going to get a simple contribution from one of the Rindler patches, but it looks like we get a contribution from another Rindler patch as well if we follow through the same procedure of the previous slide. But what we can do is to use the so-called antipodal map in ADS, which has a simple action on all of these Rindler mode functions, and we can map that contribution into a contribution in the so-called left Rindler patch. So if we do that, we wind up needing two separate contributions if we want to represent this bulk point behind the Rindler horizon. Okay, so that's going to be a general feature when we look at eternal black hole horizons. If we want to represent some kind of local bulk operator inside a horizon, we're going to need to pick up pieces from two separate boundaries. Well, at this point, they're not really separate boundaries. They're separate patches. But once we go to the black hole, they'll become separate CFTs that are correlated with each other. Okay. So that matches well with other discussions people have made about trying to represent eternal black holes in ADS-CFT. Okay, so let's go to the BTZ black hole now. So we just periodically identify this angle variable. All those previous formulas carry over immediately. The only new feature is we're just going to require that our boundary data is now periodic. So all those smearing functions will just stay exactly the same. Okay, so I guess I already said this. If we go behind a horizon, we need support on two disjoint boundaries. We need only one for points outside the horizon. So we seem to have a kind of clear signature of what happens when we have points behind a horizon. We really need these two disjoint boundaries. Okay, so if we can put a local operator inside a horizon, we can try and place it at the singularity of the BTZ black hole. And we'd like to ask how that shows up in the conformal field theory. And let me just run through a few possibilities, because it's not entirely clear what's going to go wrong here. Obviously, we're going to reproduce the supergravity result, because we're working in a limit where the CFT reproduces classical supergravity. But there are various things that could go wrong. You, for example, might find this smearing function, the mapping between the conformal field theory and the gravity theory, become singular in some way, but the conformal field theory might remain smooth. Alternatively, you might find that the large N conformal field theory, like the supergravity theory, is incomplete in some sense, that it's not completely well defined in the presence of singularities. Or you might find that the smearing function is completely smooth, but you have to look at some unpleasant operator in the CFT, which doesn't respect any of the normal kinds of conditions you'd impose on operators in the CFT in order to get well-behaved correlation functions. Okay, so, well, what's the answer? Well, we can write down what the operator is that creates a mode on the singularity, and this is it. So data is mapped into CFT operators. We're integrating over imaginary angles to define it, but there's nothing blowing up in this map between the conformal field theory and the local operator at the singularity. Everything is completely well-behaved. So we have a well-behaved smearing function. And what in fact happens is, well, if you think of it from the supergravity point of view, we kind of get a problem, because the origin, the point at r equals 0, phi equals 0, is actually a fixed point of our symmetry transformation, phi goes to phi plus 2 pi. And that's reflected in this operator that we've constructed, although it's not entirely obvious or manifest why this is invariant under phi goes to phi plus 2 pi. It looks like it would shift these arguments, and it's not immediately clear why that would drop out. But if we insert these operators into any correlation function, we can use the fact that we're actually integrating over this interval and imaginary angles to give us a contour deformation argument to show that when this operator is inserted into any correlation function, it's completely invariant under this kind of 2 pi shift. Okay, so what we end up with then is a non-normalizable operator, both on the gravity side and the CFT side. And it's non-normalizable in the sense that if we look at any correlation function with a reasonable operator in our theory, we just get an infinite answer. So,
What operator is going to be the one you find CFT?
In what?
In the boundary CFT, what operator?
So we take some, each of these gets mapped to an operator in the CFT with definite conformal dimension. One lives on the left, one lives on the right. We can work out what the correlation functions are between operators, both on the left, both on the right, and the cross terms, and compute correlation functions using the formula I showed before. And we've shown that they agree with what you get from the supergravity correlation functions.
Sorry, do you mean the phi zero become a non-normalizable operator?
This becomes a non-normalizable operator, and this expresses the mapping of it into the CFT. So each of these is directly related, can be replaced by an operator in the CFT at this point.
So you say phi zero is replaced by a non-normalizable operator. Is that right?
This is replaced by a non-normal, this becomes a non-normalizable operator.
Wait, that's the Bach operator. I'm asking the boundary.
So I get the boundary, the CFT operator that corresponds to this just by replacing these by operators in the left and right conformal field theory,
right.
Located at these points.
But the boundary operator is well defined, is that right?
Yes, the bound,
right.
the sum is completely well defined. The thing is that it becomes invariant under this transformation when we do that integral. Yeah.
Except divergence just pops up when you actually are sitting on the singularity, but as you approach the singularity, there's no sign that something's going to happen.
There's a log divergence in the radial coordinate as you approach the singularity.
I'm confused about another sort of general question about the setup. Mm-hmm. So I'm used to thinking about the normalizable piece of the field at infinity as giving you the expectation value of some CFT operator.
Yeah.
Now you seem to be identifying it with the CFT operator itself.
Yeah, that was a point I tried to emphasize before. here we go. So we really have a direct mapping between this boundary data and an operator in our CFT. So it's a bit like we've done a Legendre transformation. Okay, so
but I think because it should be considered inside the Corrie matrix, the right combination.
So you're
replacing by zero just by O. It's
So we're this formula expresses that. Yeah. So this works because we're using a different smearing function from what is usually used. Oops. I have lost my way. Okay. Good. Okay, so there's a kind of trivial sense in which the story gives a resolution of the singularity. So you might think that this boundary S matrix is your complete set of observables, and in this BTZ background, it does seem to be well defined perturbatively. because we can kind of think of all of the CFT correlators as being determined by supergravity correlators where the insertions are all just taken near the boundary, so the singularity never appears. So it looks like this conformal field theory should be well defined in this large N strong coupling limit. And you can make just the same statement on the supergravity side. If you take the point of view that the boundary S matrix is your complete set of observables, then all you're really saying is cosmic censorship is hiding the incompleteness of the gravity theory from the set of observables. So there is a sense then in which you've resolved the singularity. It's a rather trivial sense. So all you're really saying is you have a complete theory on each side, and if you have a complete description of the physics, you can regard that as a resolution of the singularity. So in this particular example, the way the singularity is showing up is that you're just looking at a bad operator in this otherwise complete theory. Of course.
But it's also a relatively trivial singularity.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
So they might just work in higher than three dimensions?
I don't think so. But, yeah, we're just looking at this particular model for now. And it would be nice to go through similar arguments in higher dimensions. And I imagine the story will be different. But this is the very simple story that we get here.
Sorry, why do you say this is a resolved singularity?
Well, by that I just mean that, you know, if you're just computing correlators in your conformal field theory, they give you a complete set of observables. There's no obvious incompleteness in that conformal field theory.
Yeah, but the same thing can be said for all CFTs, for Yamil theory, for ADS5, for others.
Yeah, this argument would work. In a kind of trivial way, whenever you have a singularity that's hidden behind a horizon. It wouldn't work for the kinds of examples that Tomas talked about, where we actually have singularities that hit the boundary. But
so are you saying just Yamil theory don't see the singularity, so that the singularity resolves?
I wouldn't want to push this too far, because if we look at large disturbances of the geometry and start thinking about back reaction, you can certainly imagine that you're going to get singularities outside your outside the horizon of your background geometry. So in that sense, this is why I said it's in a trivial sense resolves a singularity. There's obviously much more to the story that you're not seeing in this limit. This is the answer for this particular story. Okay, almost done. Let me just make a few comments about time-dependent collapse geometries. So you might have worried that what I was saying was really tied to static geometries where you could make more use of analyticity. I can at least construct this time-dependent example where pretty much the same story is going to go through. So let's say we start with pure ADS and send in a collapsing shell to make a BTZ black hole. Okay, so you might ask how you would represent a local operator inside the horizon here. So by the previous story, we would think we would really need to use two boundaries, a left and a right Rindler wedge, but the left Rindler wedge ends up crossing this shell, so it's not immediately obvious how to proceed. But actually, we can use the fact that the geometry to the future of the shell really does just look like a BTZ geometry. And in this case, we can use a trick to map the would-be left Rindler wedge into the right Rindler wedge by continuing in the time coordinate by an imaginary shift. So if you act with this on all the mode functions, it does indeed accomplish the task of mapping modes in a left Rindler wedge into the right Rindler wedge. And so if we combine that with our contribution from the right Rindler wedge, we end up with a description of this operator in terms of a smearing function that will, in general, require integrals over this entire right boundary. Okay, so the point of that is we can get away with a single conformal field theory to describe operators inside this horizon. But we need to continue both to complex time and complex angle. Okay, and finally, just let me make a few comments about how you can use these smearing functions to give a new perspective on the UVIR correspondence and holography. Okay, so let's suppose we take operators on some surface of radius R, and for definiteness, I'll work in, say, a Poincaré patch. Okay. Well, I'm going to be using these kind of de Sitter continued smearing functions, so I get compact support for these operators. And okay, so yeah, you could write that in terms of global coordinates if you wanted to, but I'll choose this way of doing things. Okay, so one thing we see from that is that we really only need to smear the CFT operators over a finite interval of time on the boundary. So we get a much kind of sharper relation between the radial position and the interval of time you need to integrate over, rather than it being some convolution with some Bessel function, which was the usual way of deriving a UVIR correspondence. We get this very sharp light cone that makes a lot of things more clear. So we could try and use that picture to give a kind of natural basis for all the commuting operators inside this region. So there's a kind of natural set of trivially commuting operators. So if we define one operator in the bulk by integrating over some causal diamond on the boundary whose time interval is set by the size of this light cone, we get some natural set of commuting operators in the bulk where the commutation is guaranteed by the locality in the conformal field theory. Okay, so
this is though in this case where you've been able to continue the boundary coordinates, right?
Well, this should just be understood as a statement in Lorentzian ADS.
This is really an integral moment, the Lorentzian, a diamond on a Lorentzian boundary.
Yeah. Okay. So the operators smeared over these regions will certainly commute with each other just based on locality in the CFT. And it's easy enough to show that if you define the time interval using the light cone, that you get a number proportional to the area of this region. Of course, at n equals infinity, you expect to recover the classical result, that you get an infinite number of operators in any given bulk volume. So we need to kind of make a guess about how this picture will extend when n is finite. So if you start looking at, say, different ways of smearing operators inside this region at finite n, then instead of those commutators being just a C number, they'll end up being some operator. So what you kind of really need to do is diagonalize and find the maximal set of commuting operators for finite n. And there's a natural guess how to do that. You just include all possible local CFT operators, but have one per diamond. And if you do that, you get the right scaling with n that would agree with a holographic bound. Okay, so up to this kind of extra assumption, this picture does seem to give a nice new perspective on the holographic entropy counting inside some kind of bulk region. So let me wrap things up. So we've seen we can build local operators behind horizons and near the singularity. And just to emphasize again, we are working at leading order as n goes to infinity and taking the strong coupling limit. And we've relied heavily on the analytic structure of the conformal field theory correlators in doing all of this. But that shouldn't be a problem. The conformal field theory is, in some sense, an ordinary quantum field theory, so we should be able to analytically continue it in the way that we've been doing. So the main open question seemed to be how to extend this to finite n and include the effect of interactions. So all these operators we've constructed immediately carry over. We've seen we can get natural sets of commuting operators on these disjoint diamonds that will commute even at finite n. The problem is at finite n, the bulk space-time interpretation doesn't generalize. And it's not quite clear what we're dealing with. But hopefully what I've described is going to be some useful starting point for building the kind of quasi-local bulk observables that we discussed with Steve yesterday. So let me end there. Thanks a lot.
BKZ case or three-dimensional case, we talked about analytic continuing to apply.
Yeah.
Now, is that supposed to be really just on the boundary, or do you analytically continue applying the bulk as well, so that you have some new notion of what your life is?
Yeah, no, we never need to think of it as a continuation in the bulk. So we can reduce everything just to a continuation on the boundary.
One thing I wonder about is, well, this all seems to work, and it's connected to your last half of this slide. This all seems to work pretty well for the free solutions. But somehow, if you're trying to reconstruct the bulk theory, you need a notion of an interacting theory. And I guess one way of putting it is, if you're going to describe that interacting theory and its effective field theory, you need things like the bulk Feynman property. So you need a notion of time ordering in bulk. And that, if you're really constructing a map from bulk to boundary, you need some notion of that in the boundary theory as well, therefore.
Yeah, I maybe should have mentioned all the correlators I was discussing were Whiteman correlators.
Yeah.
So
you really need the Feynman ones, and that's connected to this whole analyticity business as well, because you're looking at sources that produce things, say, compacts, ordered.
Well, if you're working in position space and analytically continuing, the Whiteman functions are more natural to use. But.
Let's just put it to construct the interacting theory, you really need the Feynman functions. If you have some Feynman diagram, let's say. You need the time ordering to be able to construct that.
Well, yeah, the usual output from a quantum field theory path integral are the time ordered correlators. Yeah.
So anyway, that's probably pretty non-trivial.
Once one has Whiteman functions, one can always add them together with the opposite time step function to get the time ordered correlators.
What's the step function in terms of boundary data?
Well, one could recover that from this, but...
For example, inside the horizon, how do you do the time ordering in terms of boundary time ordering?
Well, we need to use the Whiteman functions in the CFT as well, so that they come with a definite time ordering.
Suppose we want to construct the Feynman function in the box, so how do you do the time ordering if you put the operator inside the Feynman?
Well, you can always get the time-ordered correlators from the Whiteman correlators. It would be interesting to flesh that out. But
time in your boundary, how do you get from that?
Are you asking a question in the approximation he's working, or it's in deeper?
No, just the same.
So then, what's the complication? Each of his bulk operators is labeled by a bulk point,
yes,
which lives in some background,
yes,
and either has or does not have a causal relation to the other bulk.
Yes.
Which tells you if it's in the past,
okay,
space line or future.
Yes.
You just compute his Whiteman function one way, and then the other way, you either add or subtract, or you don't, depending on what the causal orientation is.
Right.
But the point is, the time is a parameter that labels the operator. It's not,
right.
It's not an operator itself.
Mm-hmm. So you think you can construct these?
I think within the approximation he was describing, it's trivial. You may have a deeper question to ask.
Okay.
Let's